Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Undergraduate Admissions and Race Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 24, 2013, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Fisher v. University of Texas at Austin. This case considered whether using race as a factor in undergraduate admission decisions is permitted by the Equal Protection Clause. In an opinion delivered by Justice Kennedy, the court held by a vote of 7-1 that because the Fifth Circuit did not hold the university to the demanding burden of strict scrutiny articulated in the Grutter and Brake precedents, its decision in favor of the university must be vacated and the case remanded for proper application of strict scrutiny. Chief Justice Roberts, as well as Justices Scalia, Thomas, Breyer, Alito, and Sotomayor joined the opinion of the court. Justices Scalia and Thomas filed concurring opinions. Justice Ginsburg filed a dissenting opinion. Justice Kagan took no part in the consideration or decision of the case. To discuss the case, we have Gil Harriet, who is a professor of law at the University of San Diego School of Law, and Peter Kersenow, who is a partner at Bench with the firm's Labor and Employment Practice Group and a member of the Diversity and Inclusion Committee. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Harriet and Mr. Kersenow.
Good afternoon to everybody. With respect to Fisher versus Texas, I think there had been some anticipation on the part of those who aren't necessarily inclined to support the current racial preference regime in college admissions that there would be some type of profound determination by the court. And there may have been a little bit of a concern that there would be a determination by the court on those who generally favor the current use of racial preferences in college admissions to achieve diversity, that their court's decision might have some significant impact that could severely curtail the use of racial admissions in the collegiate ranks and also in the law school and medical school ranks. I think that the decision of the court, while not something that had overturned the use of racial preferences, has placed some guardrails around the use of preferences in college admissions. And those guardrails, I don't think can be, should be understated. At least my initial read of this was one where I said, well, this is not something that is particularly earth-shattering. But on a closer read, I think that the court's the parameters established by the court with respect to the use of racial admissions are those that in practice may make it a little bit more difficult to use the racial preferences in the manner in which they're currently being used by some universities. Now, keep in mind, as I think everybody on this call probably understands, that any type of racial classification, the use of such racial classification by a public entity has got to pass strict scrutiny, and that may be one of the highest standards in our jurisprudence to achieve, and it has two components to it. The first is that the use of it must serve a compelling state interest. That's a very high standard. Prior to the Bakke, Grutter, and Gratz decisions, the only things that would qualify as compelling state interests were matters pertaining to national security and law enforcement and the remediation of actual instances of past discrimination. The second prong to the strict scrutiny standard is once you have established that what you're doing is a compelling state interest, it must nonetheless be narrowly tailored to serve that interest. And what the Fisher case did here is to narrow or clarify what it is that a university may do in terms of serving the compelling state interest. That is, the narrow tailoring prong is, at least in the court's wording, not entitled to any deference. The university is not entitled to any deference whatsoever by the court, and that's fairly significant. Let me, however, go back to the first prong, and that is the compelling state interest prong. There, when we saw the Supreme Court last visit this issue, it said that, well, we're going to grant universities deference in their judgment as to whether diversity is essential to their educational mission. And it did so on a First Amendment theory that flowed from Sweezy versus New Hampshire, which is a Supreme Court case from several decades earlier. And so the court said in the Grutter case, we're going to give universities a degree of deference in determining what their educational mission is. And if diversity is part of that educational mission, then we're going to defer to that determination. In this case, they say again that we will give, meaning the Supreme Court, courts generally, will give some deference to educational institutions of higher learning to define their mission in a way that says diversity is essential thereto. But again, we're not going to give any deference to how you accomplish that goal of diversity. And one of the reasons why I think that on my second read of this, that may be a little bit more significant than I originally thought is when you take a look at what universities are doing in practice, we have got at least some evidence that universities in crafting their racial admissions programs are not necessarily doing it as narrowly as one might hope. In the case of the University of Texas, they had already, to some extent, achieved diversity. In fact, they had a public pronouncement on behalf of the university that indicated that by using a race-neutral mechanism, they had significantly increased their diversity. Yet nonetheless, after Grutter was decided, they then resorted to a racial preference regime that did take race specifically into account, despite the fact that they'd achieved a measure of diversity. Now, we'll see what happens when the thing is remanded, but that implicates whether or not they are narrowly crafting the mechanism by which they achieve diversity if they've already achieved diversity before even implementing this new program. And that goes back again to prong number one, the extent to which a court's going to defer to their judgment on this. So with respect to prong number two, if universities continue to implement race-neutral programs where it is very broad, where it's more than simply a flexible or race is simply more than a flexible plus factor, where the racial preference program is not time limited, where the racial preference program is implemented without an examination by the university as to whether or not there has been some workable race neutral alternative that has been at least considered, then courts, at least the Supreme Court says courts, should look very skeptically as to whether or not the university has satisfied prong number two, the narrow tailoring prong. And I think I'll stop at that point right there. I'll let Gail add anything she would like to add to this. But I would say that there's a lot to discuss when it comes to prong number two. Easily, those who had thought that maybe Fisher could be a vehicle to cabin prong number one may have been a little disappointed by this. But prong number two has been circumscribed to a point where it's no longer something where universities can simply say, here's how we're going to do it, and courts are going to have to kind of accept that or defer to that. Now it's going to be something that's going to require a little bit more effort on the part of the universities.
One of the things that was interesting about this case was that it was a 7-1 opinion, with Ginsburg being the only dissenter. Kagan was recused. So that means that Breyer and Sotomayor were part of the majority. But the opinion that I love to read is Justice Thomas's opinion. Justice Thomas points out in his concurrence that the evidence continues to mount that race preferential admissions are doing more harm than good, even for their intended beneficiaries. So if you look at this evidence is correct. And at this point, it's becoming very difficult to deny this evidence. It means that we have fewer African-American physicians, fewer scientists, fewer African-American engineers, lawyers, college professors than we would have had had we been using race-neutral policies. So as well-meaning as affirmative action policies were originally, they've backfired badly. And at some point, colleges and universities and the courts are going to have to come to terms with that. Now, one could say, look, you know, that really shouldn't influence a decision of the Supreme Court of the United States. And I have to say, that's right, it shouldn't. Just like the Supreme Court was criticized back in the 1950s with Brown versus the Board of Education. They were criticized for making the opinion appear to hinge on the Dahl experiments that showed that black children attending segregated schools preferred white dolls to black dolls, and that this was thought to be evidence of the harm of segregation. It shouldn't have mattered what black children in the South in the 1950s thought of dolls. That, you know, the Brown versus the Board of Education should have come out the same way regardless. And in my opinion, Grutter should have come out the same way regardless. But as Thomas points out, you know, underlying the original Grutter decision was the assumption, it wasn't even good science, just the assumption that this is having a good effect on minority students. And it turns out it's not. So I think it's a very good thing that Justice Thomas has discussed this in his concurrence. I hope it receives a lot of publicity. I hope a lot of people look at it thoughtfully because I think it's important. Scalia's point was simply in his concurrence that the issue of whether to overturn Grutter was just not on the table, that during the oral argument, the attorney for the plaintiff had basically said, look, we're not seeking to overturn Grutter. We believe that Grutter properly construed wouldn't cover this case. And so we didn't get the big blockbuster decision some people wanted. But I think that nevertheless, this opinion moves in the direction of putting limits on racially preferential admissions policies, and we can expect that there will be more lawsuits. Maybe even this very lawsuit will return to the Supreme Court after remand, and that we may see further cutting back or at least clarifying the decision of the court in 2003 in Grutter versus Bollinger.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.